about his mother. They drift afloat on coastal waters. Don't go too far, the ocean's fast, and the waves will drive you fast.
Hello, and welcome to Tell Me About Your Song, the podcast where I talk to musicians and songwriters about a song they've written. Today's guest is Amy Virginia, and the song she'll be talking about is named I'll Sing You Songs When You Aren't Around, from the album of the same name. So where would you like to start with the song?
I suppose we can begin with the things that the song is about, which are the book Life of Pi, my mother, and the friend of mine who manages the cafe that was kind of like my go-to cafe whenever I first moved to New York, like my home base. And I wrote it. I remember sitting down at the restaurant across from where I used to work. I was a barista, and there was like a nice restaurant, and I had had a bad day, and I wanted to go and I wanted to sit and eat something that tasted very good and have a glass of wine and just like think about my life and the decisions I was making. And as I was eating, I was like, you know, I want to write a song that isn't about a boy. Up until that point, for the most part, every song, unless it was a song for a friend of mine, was about a boy or about the lack of a boy. Mm-hmm. Which is funny because the song begins with a boy about his mother. So I had this little field notes notebook that had a picture of a wheat field on it. I'm from the Midwest, and that was kind of like my little thing that I'd carry around to like jot all my like thoughts and feelings into whenever I was missing home or need to be like reminded of where I was from. So I pulled out my field notes notebook and started writing this song because I had just finished reading Life of Pi. It was one of those books that I tried to read when I was 14 when everyone else was reading it, and I did not like it at all. And I remember getting like 2 pages in and thinking, this is absolutely not worth my time, and putting it down. And I had wandered into a local bookshop and saw it earlier. And so I bought it and read it, and it killed me. It just broke my heart. I was addicted to it the entire time I read it. I don't know. It's one of those things where like a book finds you when you're supposed to find it. And Life of Pi found me. And so I ate it up and was reading it. And, it's this fantastical story about this boy. And because I am easily manipulated, I believed what I was reading. I forgot that it was fiction. Or I think I had convinced myself that it was based on a true story. Mm. And so I'm reading it thinking that it's real, which is interesting because it is so fantastic and magical. And then when I got to the end, spoiler alert, the boy's been telling a story. And then, like, you read about what actually happened to him while he was lost at sea. And the reality of the situation struck me so hard. And I was reading it in this cafe that is across the street from the bookstore that I used to work at. And I was trying to, like, finish it up really fast before I had to go and play music for babies. And I, like, got to the end. And that moment of truth and realization hit me. And I started crying as if I'd been broken up with, the sort of like embarrassing fat tears and like deep, heavy sobs and kind of cry. And my friend Brennan, who managed the cafe, he came over and saw me from behind. So he like walked up and like punched me in the arm, and he's like, "What's up, asshole?" And I like turned to him with this face. And he was like, "Oh God." And without skipping a beat, he picked me up off of the stool that I was sitting on, and he held me in the middle of his cafe while I just like cried in his arms, like actually held me. And it was this perfect moment of like friendship and beauty and like real human sadness. I just had that experience, which is why I needed to like sit and think about my life and like wonder what I was doing with myself. And then the song came out of that.
A girl in an apartment, she doesn't know where the time went. Oh, it's a balance till the end. And she wishes she could find a friend.
It's interesting because I went into it not wanting to write a love song. And it surprised me like how much the song is also about my own loneliness.
Mm-hmm.
The type of alone that you feel, especially in New York, is a very specific breed of aloneness. Alone while surrounded by people.
Right.
When I was writing this, I lived in a studio apartment where it was just me and my cat. And I remember when I first unpacked all of my things and the movers left me in my apartment, it was the first time really in my entire life where I would only see somebody if I chose to walk out the door and find them. There were no roommates that would walk in. My family is a very like open door family. At any time, someone might pop their head in. So, you know, be ready. But, you know, this is loneliness. And like trying to find this balance between the different parts of yourself, the part of you that wants to be alone, that needs this quiet place just for you. And then balancing that with this person that craves a community or desperately wants to be so much bigger than I want to be so much bigger than I am. And it's, oh, I just want to be on my own. And, oh, but I just want to be surrounded by people. Yeah. So I think that a lot of the song is about, yeah, loneliness. And that's why, you know, it ends with this like huge swell, because ultimately I just want it to blow up and be big. Mm-hmm. Comes out of this like strong desire to be closer to the people that I love that I don't get to see. My parents live very far away from me. Not very far. Some people's parents live across the world, but Fargo feels very far away from New York City. And I see them, you know, once a year, maybe twice. And when I was in school, I was studying theater, and they would come down from Fargo to Kansas to watch me do every single show that I was in. And my mom had to miss a show. And it was hard to perform not for her, mostly because she wanted to be there so bad, and I knew that. And so it's hard in New York whenever I do a thing that I wish she could see and she wishes she could see. But also, to get a little more morbid, I suppose, like it's for when she dies. The old people in my family have started passing away, and I've had to watch her as she takes care of them. We all have to prepare for that day where our parents get old, or where our parents lose their minds and they forget who we are, or they forget who they are. But I just want her to know that I'm always singing for her. It's so sappy. I'm not that sappy of a person, but actually I am. I had run a like Kickstarter campaign for a play that I'd written, and my mom had contributed the amount of money that warranted a song. And I still hadn't written her a song. And I didn't even mean to write her this song. It started off really just being about this book. And about halfway through, I realized that it was also about the relationship that I had with my mom. You know, in the book, the boy watches his mother get killed before him. And she's being very brutally and horrifically murdered as she's like fighting to defend her son. I've never given my mom credit enough for how brave and excellent she is. We didn't get along very well growing up. And, you know, reading it, I was just so full of love for my mother. And then the song kind of took shape around this need for like community and big feelings and truth seeking. And my mother is kind of at the center of all of that.
What did she say when you sent it to her?
She loves it. She loves it so much. She actually has, I have a different song that I wrote for my mom that's not recorded, and it's a traveling song, but it's very like, you know, the chorus is like, mama, 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 hailing from Dakota, like straight up, obviously for my mom. And I think that she liked that this song was a really strong connection between the two of us, like very much about me, very much about her, but also a little more like universally for everyone. Mm-hmm. And it accidentally became her... My mom's not good at things like technology. And it accidentally became like the ringtone for her phone. But she couldn't figure out how to make it louder. So she would just forget that she was listening to me singing. And like it would like follow her around. And she'd be like, I just keep hearing you sing. And then I forget that it's my phone. And then I don't answer it because I'm enjoying listening to you sing. And then I miss every phone call. You know? But yeah, she likes it.
Thank you.
perform it, I sing, "They rarely change." And then at the end of it, I say, "They never change." And I think that probably like my favorite line out of the whole thing is those last two lines of the chorus. There's something to making an impression on someone beyond even what you can remember.
The thing where the chorus is a little different at different times.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a technique you use often in your songs?
Yeah. It's born out of the fact that I don't like permanence. And the first 2 years that I played music, I on purpose only played live. I didn't record. Clown training makes it so that I like being able to like react to an audience. I also am kind of notorious for forgetting the words to my own song.
All right.
Because I'll get excited by like the present and, mm-hmm. you know, maybe someone made a good face at me or maybe I have this like nice interaction going on and then I'll get caught up in that and forget. Which when I played with the band, I needed to work really hard so that I wasn't screwing up and then letting them down by not knowing what I was doing. It kind of comes out of this habit of changing things, modifying them to fit a situation. But also, I think that when we did the recordings for the album, I had to make decisions. I had to say, this is when I'm singing this, this is when I'm singing this. And that was when it became very intentional. Like, you want to say never here because you want to make the point of things actually don't ever change. As opposed to rarely, which is flimsy. Home where things are still the same, yeah, they never change. I really hope to be a very dynamic human. The person that I am now is extremely different from the person that I was when I was in high school or in college or the first year that I spent in New York City. I think that being able to adapt and evolve as a human is so important. But then when you go home, you kind of revert back into who you were growing up or who you are with your family, mostly because things are kind of still the same, especially, you know, when I go home, my accent comes back, my like behavioral patterns from high school. I was a little quieter and distant and a little surlier comes back. But also, you know, my family is very consistent. My brother has special needs and he has a very specific schedule. My dad has been a professor my entire life and he's gotten, you know, promoted and has moved up, but it's always been within the academic world. And my mother has her routine that's also very specific. So it's interesting how no matter how dynamic you try to be, you can't help but also like go home and be like, well, okay. I'm also still just, you know, the me that I was when I was 5 years old.
He runs a solid business. He cleans up other people's messes. Oh yeah, he always knows my name and he's pretty glad I came.
That's the part about my friend Brennan. The cafe is called Gasoline Alley, and it opened up in my first year in New York. It's still a really wonderful cafe, but Brennan was one of those people that he made a point of building a community around his little space. And it wasn't just like me who he knew, but like, you know, you'd hang out with him there and you would be able to like talk to everyone. And my friend Patrick and I refer to that first year of Gasoline Alley as like the golden age of Gasoline Alley because every barista knew everyone. And I don't know. I think that there's something special about that place, especially in a big city where you kind of just want people to know you, finding those places that are your like homes. It's so hard to go home for a moment here. You know, you go into the city and then you're in the city right. until you go home to fall asleep. And that place, especially when he was there, was like a comfort for me.
So the line is, he cleans up other people's messes.
I mean, that's like the truth of working in a cafe, which is, you know, you're wiping tables or cleaning up spilled coffee, but also, you know, you're picking up the weeping girl who's just finished reading a book and doesn't know how to quite go on with her life. Mm-hmm. So several different kinds of messes.
A boy recounts a journey. He tells two very different stories. He leaves it up to you to choose which one of them could be the truth. Row, row, row your boat.
Oh, the row, row, row your boat row, part.
Row, gently out to sea.
I wrote the song Up Until Then first. And I remember I was sitting with a guy that I was dating at the time. And then I got to the end. And I remember saying, And then I think I want people to sing Row, Row, Row Your Boat. And I remember him looking at me and saying, that's the worst idea you've ever had. And I was convinced that it could work. I was sure that it would be so good to sing Row, Row Your Boat. He kept being like, no, it's a terrible idea. And finally I convinced him to sing it with me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I taught him the modified version that I put into the song.
Yep.
And got him going. And then I sang the chorus over it. And at the end, he was like, wow, crap. Okay, it's good.
Excellent.
Right?
Yeah.
And people are always a little skeptical whenever I tell them I'm going to make them sing Row, Row Your Boat. Like when I perform it, I always make the audience sing along with me and get them, you know, rolling with it and then start to sing the chorus over it. And everyone's always kind of like, row, row, row your boat, you know. But then by the end, they're singing it really loud, and it's funny to watch people approach like a childhood song and then find like joy and delight in singing along with it.
Yeah, and it's cool the way that you do it. You sing the chorus over it, then you start singing, but then it's shifted. So it's a little callback to the round nature of Row, Row, Row Your Boat.
Exactly. Yeah, and it's fun because you can get people to sing it like really loud, and then you can tell them to sing it really soft. And at that point, they'll do anything I ask them to do, usually, if it's a good audience, you know. And so then it's fun for me to play with them and have it like gently peter out and hold on to the silence at the end for a while and see everyone kind of be like, oh, we just did that. It's my favorite thing to do.
It sounds like when you started writing this song, you started out with the lyrics and added music later, or?
You know, the way I write pretty much any song, the lyrics and the tune come at once.
Mm.
Usually it's like as words are being written down into the notes portion of my iPhone, it's with a tune that accompanies it. And then like the tune will get edited if it sounds too much like another thing or isn't exactly right. I'm not actually that good of a singer. My vocal range is limited and my ability is what it is. I don't try to like be bigger than I am. And so I tend to like make up for what I think is a lack of vocal talent with content, but also like making my songs a little chattier. I think that's why they're all kind of wordy. The sing-songiness mostly is because I like to come up with melodies that I can like walk around stuck in my head.
There's kind of a ocean or nautical theme that goes through the whole thing.
Before coming to New York, I was going to this clown school in Northern California. It was the first time that I'd ever lived near the ocean. And I dated a guy in undergrad who, when we were, you know, talking about getting married and where we would live in the future, he was like, well, it has to be by an ocean. And I remember saying, that doesn't make sense. Why would it have to be by an ocean? And he had grown up traveling around, but by several different oceans. And he had this need for and connection to bodies of water that, growing up landlocked, I never understood until that year. And the Pacific Ocean of Northern California is a very specific ocean to fall in love with. It isn't your typical sunny beaches. Let's like lay out and play volleyball. It's scary. On like a gloomy day, it's very post-apocalyptic. I don't know. I fell so madly in love with it. And even now, whenever I need to be reminded how small I am, I go out to a beach somewhere and put myself next to her and just know that I could decide to walk out into it and never come back. You know, it's also about like religion. The book Life of Pi is so like wrapped up in religion. And the part where it says, if you open your mouth wide, you could fit the seams high-eyed. There's a part in the book where, you know, they're like retelling a fable, and the whole point is that a god is in disguise and you don't realize that this character figure is a god until he opens his mouth and you see the entire universe inside of the mouth of this like animal. And then it's like, oh crap. I don't know. I really loved that image. It blew my mind and met me in a place where I'm in a constant state of wondering, what's it all about? What is true? What is... The boy in the book takes from several different religions or philosophies. The religious officials from each religion realize that he's going to all, you know, to these different like churches or temples, And they approach him, this child, and say, you need to choose. Which one do you want to believe? Which one is right? And his whole thing was, why can't they all be right? Mm-hmm. Why can't they all apply to me? Why can't I take the best parts of these things and abide by them? Which resonated with me so perfectly. I was raised very specifically one way, but always had lots of like questions and curiosities. And now my, you know, my personal life religion and practice is very patchwork quilt. Mm-hmm. But that line about fitting the sea inside your mouth, that's basically just like maintaining this sense of like awe and wonder.
I feel like that connects with the last verse also, where he leaves it up to you to choose which one of them could be the truth.
It brings it right back. Because, you know, he does, like in the book, he does, he says, all right, you can either believe the story I just told you, or you can believe this second story. And then he tells this other story, and it seems truer, but it's also easier to believe the fantastic version of what he experienced. And you have to kind of like, as a reader, choose as well what you want to believe. And of course, I was like, you know, ruined for a month after it. Like, I stopped eating meat for a while. I like would like cry randomly in different places.
I haven't heard you do it solo, but in the recording, at least, the verses have this kind of reggae beat to them.
Uh-huh.
And then the chorus kind of picks up and is more poppy, maybe, in a way.
Totally.
So is that something that was a feature of the song from the beginning?
No, actually, I have a YouTube video of me playing it right after I'd written it. I was recording it to send it to my friend Shane, and then I ended up just putting it up online. And it's very slow.
A boy, a boat, his mother. They drift afloat on coastal waters. Don't drift too far, the ocean's vast, and the waves will drive you fast.
It has this like quality of waves to it. You know, it bobs in the way that you would if you were on a boat. And whenever I played it for Lorenzo, who produced my album and is my closest musical collaborator, he kind of took the songs that I'd written and I had recorded for him with just me and my ukulele, and then he sat with them and presented to me what he thought was in my head.
I'll sing you songs.
And we would then collaborate on like what was good, what should change. And I remember before he played me the demo for this one, he said, now, this one's different, but just listen to it.
A boy about his mother.
And the first time I heard it, it was very strange because I am not reggae-y. you know, I'm very much folk pop precious.
Mm-hmm.
So my initial reaction was, huh, interesting. And then I listened to it again. And again, and I just fell in love with it because it's a different ocean feel, but it still feels like waves, but it's waves that are a little more confident. And I'm so lucky that I have a collaborator that inspires that confidence, that recognizes what something can be and makes like a really brave, bold choice. Because it was definitely like a bold choice to end a folk pop album with a reggae song. There are two parts in the recording of the song that I like live for. And it's at the end of that middle portion where I'm talking about the girl in her apartment. And I say, and she wishes she could find a friend. And then the saxophone comes in and it's as if that's the friend.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
When we played it live, Danny Meyer is the saxophone player on the album and he plays with me live also. I love listening to it when I'm by myself, but whenever he did it live in front of a room full of people, I just beamed. Like, I almost forgot to sing because I was so happy to hear him. And then that part at the end, before I start singing Row, Row Your Boat, and it just gets really quiet, and mm-hmm. and the guitar just goes, you know, bum, ba, bum, bum, ba, bum, ba, bum, bum, and it's sweet and small. I like that the song kind of goes between all those different modes.
A boy recounts a journey. He tells two very different stories. He leaves it up to you to choose which one of them could be the truth. Row, row, row your boat.
Up until recording, it was very much a solo thing. And then Lorenzo like got me drunk one night and was like, you have to let me produce your album. And I had been saying no for a year. And that night, probably because I was wasted, I was like, fine, sure, do it. And then when we had a meeting about it, he had asked me if I wanted to bring in musicians that I've worked with. And I trust him completely. He is so good at what he does. And he's been doing it for so long that I really did. I wanted him to have full control over that. If he was going to be the person who was working with these musicians, I wanted him to hire people that he wanted to work with. When it comes down to it, I don't know that much about recording. So it was really cool to walk into the room and meet these people. I didn't meet them until we had our first rehearsal for the album release show, you know, so I'm handing them their copy of the album and saying, thank you so much for playing on this. And they're hoping that I'm not a horrible person to play with. And that was honestly the coolest thing, was to go from having the guys that played on my album to having the guys that are the band that I play with. Something that I just remembered about the recording of this, I wrote it in one key, but we recorded it in a different key. It is higher than what I wrote it to be. I taught myself how to play ukulele, and so I only know so much.
Right.
And so it's like, you write all of your songs in this key. We're changing this one. It's going to be different. And I was like, no! And he made it go higher, and I was so nervous because I'm a little vocally limited, and so I was trying to like have confidence in the fact that it will sound fine and I will sound fine. But the chorus, I was having trouble like maintaining clarity and consistency with the notes I was hitting. And so I was in the studio in this little, you know, like box, this like carpet covered closet, singing into the microphone. And Lorenzo was trying to work with me to like hit the notes. And finally, it's like, you know what? I'm just going to try something weird. Because in clown school, whenever we were working to build a sound, we would connect physical action to it. And we would push against the wall to like build physical momentum, to like apply your strength to a thing while making noise. So all the choruses are recorded with me leaning all of my weight against the wall and the microphone's hanging in front of my face between me and the wall, pushing while singing, which is kind of weird and hard to do when you play live.
Yes, right.
You know, you imagine recording looks so sexy.
Oh, no.
At least I always imagine recording to like look so sexy.
Right. Well, in the movies, it's always...
Oh, yeah, right.
People dressed to the nines, like just sitting in front of the cool looking microphone.
When really it's like you in your sweatpants and you've been doing it for the past 3 hours and you just wish it could sound better and you're leaning against the wall. I sang all my backup vocals, but I wanted to have like lots of voices for this song. Mm-hmm. So I had, I think, 10 of my friends come in. Friends from college, friends from clown school, friends from, one was a friend who was one of the regulars at the cafe where I worked, you know, and they all came into the recording studio and we made them sing Row, Row, Row Your Boat over and over and over and over again. And it was so fun. And it's like that thing where you reach a point of madness because you've been doing something for so long, you know, and so you could watch this like interesting arc of human behavior where everyone came in and they were really excited to sing it. And then they kind of realized how ridiculous it is. And then they got a little tired, but then suddenly like delirium settles in and they're like ridiculous and dancing around and screaming. And it was the very last thing we did before we started mixing it. So I got to like ride this like triumphant celebratory evening with my friends into the finishing of a thing. I think that's the part where it becomes about them. And ultimately, like, that's why you make a thing, so that someone can have it.
Was it a bunch of people around a microphone, or were people recorded individually? Or
it was all 10 of us, and there were several microphones set up, and, you know, everyone had headphones on so they could hear themselves. And it was cool because it was, you know, most of my friends, it was their first time being in, like, a recording studio in that situation. Mm-hmm. And so we were all like, oh, this is what, like, oh, I can hear myself. Oh, that's great, you know. There were, like, 2 people per microphone and room to dance around and feel it as you went.
Is there a particular place that you tend to put this in a set?
It's usually a thing that I do at the end. Mm-hmm. And even when I perform the album with the band, the album itself ends with me with my ukulele alone singing the song about my hometown. But when I play it live, I swap this song and that song So I play by myself, and then it ends with the audience singing with me.
A big rave up.
Yeah, you don't, you can't really like do anything else after this one. Because once you get them singing, I feel like once you get a crowd to participate with you and join in, then I would just want to keep playing with them.
Have you gotten any particular reactions to the song that have been memorable?
People get Row, Row Your Boat stuck in their head very quickly.
Mm-hmm. You I know? Bet.
Everyone that came and saw the release show, you know, I was getting messages 5 days later that was like, I still have Row, Row Your Boat stuck in my head.
I don't know. Is there anything else that you feel like we haven't talked about?
I think the song can only be so unpacked, you know?
Yeah.
It yep. is, after all, just a song about a book and Row, Row, Row Your Boat.
Mm-hmm. Well, if people would like to hear more of your music, what should they do?
I have a website, amyvirginia.com, and it has links to all of the different types of pages that I am on. So SoundCloud and Bandcamp and YouTube. And then it also talks about the other things that I do with my life, which are avant-garde theater. And I also co-founded a company called Spring Street Social Society that produces unique experiences at which New Yorkers can connect to other interesting New Yorkers. So that's where you'd go.
And that's where all your shows and things are.
Exactly.
So if people want to hear my music, they are welcome to go to my website, which is at music.jwgh.org. And then I also have a blog for this podcast. You can go to yoursongpodcast.tumblr.com, and I'll have links to all the websites and all the things that we've been talking about. And there's also a website for the podcast at tellmeaboutyoursong.com. So with all that said, we're going to go out and listen to the song that we've been discussing in full, Amy Virginia's song, I'll Sing You Songs When You Aren't Around, from the album of the same name. Thanks for listening.
A boy about his mother, they drift afloat on coastal waters. Don't go too far, the ocean's vast, and the waves will drive you fast. A tiger in a dreamscape, will I remember when I wake? And if I open my mouth wide, I can fit the sea inside. She doesn't know where the time went. Oh, it's a balance till the end. And she wishes she could find a friend. Tells two very different stories. He leaves it up to you to choose which one of them could be the truth. Row, row, row your boat. Row, row, row your boat. Gently out to sea. Merrily, oh, merrily. Row, row, row your boat. Row, row, row your boat gently out to sea. Merrily, oh, merrily. I'll sing you songs when you are around.
I mean, I guess I was thinking, or like, I mean, I don't know why I'm explaining this.
No, go for it.
This has to do with anything, but like the verse and the chorus, they have a very different, like the verse, da 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 da, like, you know, it's mm-hmm. very, it moves mm-hmm. up and down a lot.
Oh yeah.
And then the chorus, it, da 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 da, you know, it like kind of stays on the same note, mm-hmm. and then it has this sort of specific shape to it.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. Sometimes I just refuse to ask questions.
No, it's okay. I don't mind. Your interview style is very interesting.
Okay. That's very diplomatic.
So, I am diplomatic at best.
I appreciate it. But I suppose that does sort of bring up the, you know, there is that, like,